We are TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.
Hello, 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 and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, to your daily dose of deprogramming. My name is JD Moore. We are live, just like we are every single day, and we did it, ladies and gentlemen. We made it through another week. It is Friday. I can feel the weekend. It is right there. I can see it. I can almost taste it. It's right there. I hope you guys are gearing up for a good weekend. I hope you guys have some big plans. I have, personally, a huge stack of books that I'm going to try and read this weekend. And so Boulevard and I are going to hang out, try and stay warm, get some reading done. Super excited about next week's lineup. There's going to be some amazing programs next week. Definitely want you guys to stay tuned for that. Want to thank everybody, as usual, for being here, for choosing to make this a daily stop in your prescription for truth, as it were, as many people are finding the website at redpillreports.com, checking it out. We're getting a lot of great feedback. Want to recommend everybody go there today to get into the show section. We are going to be speaking with Andrew Gauss later today. Andrew is essentially an economic historian and a numismatic expert, which is the study of coins and fine money and things like that, the grading of precious metals. And we're going to talk about the shadow banking system. We'll talk a little bit about the fractional reserve system. We'll probably talk quite a bit about the history of money and the future of money as we move towards this BRICS development, and also as we move into the realm of Bitcoin. So he is a very animated speaker. I think you guys will really enjoy listening to him. He's also an author. He's written a couple of great books on money and is working on his third one right now. So definitely go to the show section at redpillreports.com and check that out. There's also a click here to listen live button if you would like to listen live to the show. Redpillreports.com is where you want to go for that. There's also a phone number if you're one of these people that wants to keep your data charges under control and you may have unlimited minutes like a lot of us do nowadays. You can dial in at 832-225-5308 and you will find us that way. Save your data, but you'll be able to listen to us over the phone. Want to also mention Jamie Hanshaw is going to be joining us on Monday to talk about Monarch programming, mind control, and things like that. I'm telling you, this show has just taken off, ladies and gentlemen. The guests that the co-creators, Jeff and Rob, are able to cultivate for this show. I just cannot tell you guys how awesome it is to be here and part of this family. Also part of the Truth Frequency Radio family. Man, what a great organization these guys have, and they've made us feel so welcome. So please go and support Truth Frequency Radio. Also, give them a couple of dollars and keep us at the top of the heap in terms of alternative news. I also have to report, ladies and gentlemen, that I, myself, reached a milestone last night. I accomplished something amazing. Yes, I did it, ladies and gentlemen. I sat through all of Barack Obama's speech yesterday. And I tell you what, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. I had to be sedated. I had to put a seatbelt on. There was a helmet involved. And I had a bowl here just in case he, you know, something negative happened and I had to. Anyways, I did it. I made it through the whole speech. It was, atrocious, I guess would be the word that I would use. Awful, disgusting, full of lies. I'm kind of, allergic to horse hockey too, so I was all, strung out on Benadryl yesterday before the speech. But I did make it through that, and we are going to talk about that today because, obviously the Republican part of the country, the conservative part of the country, is obviously way up in arms at this point, and a lot of back and forth between Boehner and Obama after his speech yesterday. So we will get into that when we get into the news here in just a second. Let everybody know if you're a new listener. Normally what we do every day is we spend the first hour going over all the pertinent news of the day, things that we think are super important and need to talk about. And then in the second hour, we always have a fantastic guest. So that's what's going on today. Again, Andrew Gauss will be joining us in the second hour. I wanted to, before we jump into the news today, because it's Friday, I like to kind of keep things a little lighter on Friday, and because the two co-creators can really only reach out to me by Skype, so they can't hit me for wasting time. So I'm going to just indulge myself and tell you guys a little story right now. And the reason I want to talk to you about this story, and this is a story of a presentation that a philosophy teacher made to his class. Somebody sent me an article about it yesterday, and it really, really put things into perspective for me, and I hope it does the same for you. But we're talking about priorities right now, and as we move into this holiday season, people start to lose their minds. That's what happens. People start worrying about holiday shopping and all of these things that just don't matter. You know, are we listening to Christmas carols too early? All kinds of ridiculous stuff. So this philosophy teacher has a great demonstration regarding priorities, and I wanted to kind of bring this to everyone's attention just because I think it's a good story. So we're talking about a teacher giving a presentation to his philosophy class, and the presentation starts with the teacher having a large 2-gallon bell jar that is empty sitting on his desk, right, in a class full of students. So he essentially reaches into his desk, pulls out a bag of golf balls, and he pours the golf balls into this large bell jar until the jar is full. He looks then at the classroom and he asks the students if they agreed that the jar was full. And every student obviously agreed jar was full, right? Okay, so the teacher then reaches back down into his desk and he pulls out a bag of pebbles. And he starts pouring the pebbles into the jar filled with golf balls. And the pebbles, of course, find their way to the open spaces between the golf balls and continue to fill the jar all the way to the top. He then asks the class again, you know, is the jar full? All of them said, yeah, of course, it's full. He says, okay. So he reaches back into his desk and he pulls out a bag of sand. He starts pouring this sand into the jar with the golf balls and the pebbles, and the sand starts filling in all of the little spaces between the golf balls and the pebbles. Fills it all the way to the rim, and then once again asks his class, you know, is this jar full? All of them obviously agreeing that the jar is now technically about as full as you could possibly get it. He then smiles again, reaches back down into his desk, and he produces a quart of chocolate milk. Okay. And he pours that chocolate milk into the jar filled with golf balls, pebbles, and sand, and it fills in all of the space that's left in the jar all the way to the top. Probably didn't look very appetizing at that point. And he again asks the class, is the jar full? And all of them, of course, say, yes, of course the jar is full. And he says, okay, here's what I want you to recognize, is that this jar represents your life, okay? The golf balls represent the important things like your family, your children, your health, your friends, and your passions. If everything else was lost from the jar, your life would still be full. He says the pebbles then represent all the other things in your life that matter, like your job, your house, your education, your car. And then the sand is everything else, all the little things, the things that you don't matter, the bills you pay, the worrying about holiday music, things like that. So the same goes for your life. He says if you spend all your time and energy on the small stuff and fill your life up with all those little things, you'll never have room in your life for the important stuff like the golf balls and the pebbles. He says, go and enjoy time with your family, go to dinner with your spouse, play games with your kids. There will always be time left to clean the house or take yourself shopping. And the student sat there quietly for about 30 seconds or so, taking it all in. When finally a brave boy raised his hands and says, I understand all of that, priorities, that makes sense to me, but you didn't mention anything about the chocolate milk. And the teacher just smiled and he says, well, the chocolate milk is really just to illustrate that no matter how full your life is, there's always room for chocolate. Isn't that great? Priorities, guys, priorities. You have to remember there are things that are important and there are things that are not important. And we're moving into a season right now where remembering what is important and being thankful for it is going to be the key to your holiday happiness, in my opinion. So I just want everybody to reflect on that for a second. Remember, focus on the big stuff. All that little stuff, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference at all, guys. Speaking of not making any difference, I am hesitant to jump back into the international news right now. And I'll just preface this by saying nothing has changed, you guys. Nothing's happened since yesterday except more ridiculousness. I'm not even going to look at the headlines right now. We'll just say it out loud. Let's see here. Ukraine and Russia still in turmoil. Netanyahu still being a jerk to the Palestinians, who are in turn still being a jerk back to the Israelis, and let's see, probably protests in Hong Kong still going on. Let's see, that's about all I can remember off the top of my head. So let's just jump in to the international news. We'll get it out of the way here quickly. The Iranian nuclear talks still in the news, and they are now saying they're probably going to have to increase the deadline. Deadline we're talking about is for resolving a 12-year-old dispute over Iran's nuclear program, and it may be extended from Monday until March. March. That's not weeks, guys. That's like months. Because of sharp disagreements between Tehran and world powers, officials close to the talks said yesterday. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was due to meet Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Zarif with European Union envoy Catherine Ashton to try and break the stalemate. But talk of the extension prompted calls for tougher sanctions in Washington. The United States and its allies had hoped this week that talks in Vienna would be the culmination of months of difficult diplomacy between Iran and the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China on their comprehensive agreement. The aim, of course, is to remove sanctions on Tehran in exchange for curbs on its own atomic program. But the talks have been deadlocked, as we have been reporting over and over on Red Pill Reports, and the timing for lifting sanctions and future scope of Iran's uranium enrichment are, of course, stumbling blocks. And this article goes on and on and on and on and on, but it basically says that they're going to extend the deadlines. We have no idea whether or not Iran is going to curb their nuclear program, and so that's what's happening there. Moving into the Russian situation, Vladimir Putin actually made a pretty stark announcement yesterday, a couple of them actually, one of which we'll get into in the next article. But the first one is that he is demanding 100% guarantees that the Ukraine will never join NATO. And the organization continues to accuse Russia of aggravating the situation in the Ukraine and breaking the ceasefire truce from September. They've also accused NATO, I'm sorry, Russia has counter-accused NATO of pushing too close to the Russian borders. And these remarks follow Putin's declaration that no one will ever dominate or influence Russia. Putin also claimed that the United States wants to subdue Russia and solve their problems, speaking about the United States, at Russia's expense. So Russia now upping the ante yet again, demanding guarantees that NATO will not be taking Ukraine into the fold. Also, bears mentioning also that Finland right now is kind of on the cusp of joining NATO, which they are kind of on the fence about because of their location next to Russia, and Russia's putting a lot of pressure on them as well to, instead of joining NATO, to work more closely with the Russian economy given their shared airspace and close proximity. So Finland also in the news with NATO and Russia right now. And a new Russian gun law went into effect yesterday. And this report is up at redpillreports.com under the World News section. So please go and check this out. This is huge, guys. This is absolutely huge. After a change to a national gun law happened on Tuesday, Russians can now carry guns in public for the purpose of self-defense. Wow, what a move. This new policy allows the use of weapons to protect the lives, health, and property, but not against women, disabled people, or minors unless they attack you with a group in arms. So if a whole mess of women show up in a big group with arms, you have your permission from Putin to defend yourself against them, but not individually. So just bear that in mind as we move forward here. And he says these weapons include long-barreled weapons, pistols, revolvers, homemade tubeless firearm units with cartridges. Isn't that amazing? They're actually including homemade firearms in this national new law that's going to allow people to carry concealed over there. That's just amazing to me. It also includes bullets and ammunition, gas pistols and revolvers, electric shock devices, and devices equipped with tear gas, and homemade spark gaps. So you could actually make your own taser in Russia now and carry it publicly concealed without a permit and get away with it. Isn't that amazing? I just can't even imagine that they're making changes like that. He also says, additionally, those who have attained licenses are prohibited from carrying weapons during rallies, meetings, demonstrations, recreational activities, and religious ceremonies, according to arguments and facts. During certain events and parades, however, Cossacks and participants of the events will be allowed to carry their swords as part of their costumes. Prior to this change, weapons were only allowed for hunting and sporting events in Russia, as well as training and shooting practice for law enforcement and things like that. Laws also prohibited rifles, pistols, and revolvers. So this is, again, this is huge. This is major, major Putin sticking his nose or his thumb out to the UN and their whole global anti-firearms policy. So there's a big kick in the pants to the UN from Putin, and also probably a big kick in the pants to the United States as they're now flaunting, you know, some of the things that our government is fighting us on. It's just amazing to me. I mean, Putin every day just has my vote for president of the universe more and more. I'm just saying. Moving on to the ISIL situation, French ISIL militants urge fellow Muslims to launch attacks back home. Yesterday, three French members of the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant have appeared on a new militant propaganda video. These men were seen burning what appear to be their passports and then proceed to call on others to join them in Syria or to bring terror to the streets of France. So not good. It's estimated right now that about 1,000 French jihadists may have gone to Syria and Iraq, and the French government says that close to 50 French citizens have died in the fighting there. And earlier this month, France convicted its first returnee with a jail sentence of 7 years, and the French police have also been given special new powers to confiscate passports to prevent people from traveling to join the militants, which is also what the UK has done. I'm not sure if the United States has followed suit on that yet, but I know that UK and France now, as indicated by this report, have curtailed allowing people to return back to their country after traveling to join the militants. So interesting stuff right there. France definitely has a problem with multiculturalism, and that will probably be exasperated by this this new directive from the ISIS militant group trying to get fomented violence on the streets of France. Good times. Good times. Happy to be part of it all. Senior ISIS figure killed in Mosul yesterday. An Islamic State leader has been killed in an airstrike in the northern Iraq city of Mosul. Residents and local media source said on Thursday it was a result of their car being struck by an airstrike, most likely led by the United States. He had been the Islamic State Wali, or governor of Mosul, which was captured by the group back in June and remains the largest city in a self-declared Islamic State caliphate straddling the border between northern Iraq and eastern Syria. So what did we do? We created a vacuum that will be filled by some other guy, most definitely right off the bat. And a new report coming from aides at the White House say Obama is now open to limits in war authorization against this group, ISIS. And the Obama administration now saying they're open to limits on the duration of its military efforts in Iraq and Syria and on the potential use of ground forces in a new war authorization against the Islamic State, according to a top presidential advisor yesterday. Tony Blinken, currently the President Barack Obama's deputy national security advisor, said discussions would continue with Congress on updating the legal basis for U.S. intervention. Wondering if we have any legal basis for our intervention there, and I think the answer to that is no. I want to draw your attention to an incident that happened in Iceland over the week here. Iceland has secured a conviction against the last of the former chief executives of its three largest banks as the Nordic island continues to plow on a lone furrow in its attempt to prosecute the misdeeds of the financial crisis. We're talking about Richard Milne, who is the Nordic correspondent. He is reporting that a gentleman who is the former chief executive of Landsbanki was sentenced to 12 months in prison for market manipulation, but 9 months were suspended. I would love to tell you these guys' names, but because they are from Iceland and because I don't speak Icelandic, I would massacre them. But Iceland is unique in the Western world for actively targeting the top management of its former banks as it aggressively investigates the financial crimes committed during the run-up to their collapse. Very, very cool stuff going on in Iceland as they are actually jailing bankers over there, which is something that we could all be doing here, but we choose not to. So there you go. Probably has something to do with the revolving door between the Fed and all of the large financial institutions. But maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that with Andrew Gauss at 11 o'clock today. We'll save some of that for later. North Korea has responded to the UN with a threat of a nuclear test. Once again, this would be the fourth nuclear test carried out by North Korea, and it is in a response to the UN allegations of crimes against humanity being carried out in some of the detainment centers in the northern part of Korea there. And obviously they find it very unusual that while asking about human rights conditions that North Korea would just turn around and threaten to retaliate by testing more nuclear arms. But that's what they're doing. So there you go with that. A Swedish appellate court has denied WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange his bid to have his arrest warrant set aside. The Australian remains wanted in Sweden for questions regarding an alleged sex offense back in 2010, although Assange has not ever been formally charged with a crime. And according to his attorneys, they have a signed affidavit from the woman that he supposedly slept with, and she says that she's not accusing him of rape. So it's really the police, according to Assange's lawyer, that are making up the charges in this. But as a result of the case, Assange has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was granted asylum back in 2012, and the embassy in turn is constantly surrounded by London police, and the city government is spending about $16,000 a day to keep an eye on Assange, and he refuses to go to Sweden over fears that he will be extradited to the United States to face further potential charges relating to WikiLeaks' publication of classified materials. We had the story yesterday where he has come out and said that there will be a fourth round of documents that they are going to have on WikiLeaks. No date for that yet, but perhaps that pressure is now why we see his arrest warrant being set aside. And another interesting story coming out of Red Flag this morning, outlining the fact that Mexico charges Americans for crossing the border. I didn't know that. Did you know that? They charge us on foot. If we're foot traffic and we're going to go into Mexico for more than 7 days, $28 a pop. Did you know that? I didn't know that. See, now we give the people who come here on foot way more than $28 worth a day in terms of housing and clothing and food and things like that. But if you want to go to Mexico and you're going to spend more than 7 days there, you're going to pay $28 a pop, ladies and gentlemen. So there you go. That's what's going on there. Moving into national news right now. My goodness, lots and lots and lots to talk about. One of the stories that is going to be disappeared from the internet very quickly, I feel. And this was corroborated also by Mel at over at Truthstream Media. She sent me an article yesterday and kind of outlined some of this for me and really made the point that this is probably going to be deleted from the internet soon. But we're talking about the Florida State shooting that happened yesterday. And the man identified as the shooter who opened fire at Florida State University Library was a former prosecutor who descended into paranoia and recently posted on Facebook asking questions if people had been encouraged by their handlers to kill people for the promise of freedom. Now, think about that for a second. Is that a trend that we've seen before? Remember the African-American lady who was gunned down in front of the White House? She reported hearing voices. Something told her to go to the White House. Remember the guy who jumped the fence? No, the guy who approached Secret Service. We had that story yesterday, had the rifle and the ammunition in his car. Said a voice had told him to come to Washington, D.C., so that's what he did. I mean, this gentleman was a lawyer, right? He was a an alumni from Florida State University. He obviously, according to his friends and family, very stable guy. He just got his law degree from Texas Tech and was moving back to New Mexico so he could hang out a shingle and pass the bar exam. I'm sorry, doing that in Florida. Pardon my intrusion there. So he was essentially going to become a lawyer. He has been a lawyer. He's going out. He's going to start his own practice, and everything, according to his friends and family, were very good. But then his Facebook page, although it suggests that he was a devout Christian because it's filled with biblical quotes, in other postings, it starts really outlining this paranoia streak on the Targeted Individuals International page. He wrote that he was a lawyer and he was mulling legal action, and he also announced on the 15th of November that he had formed a group for every targeted individual who wanted to pursue a class action lawsuit. Now, isn't that just amazing? And the details of that, where a gentleman thinks that he is being targeted by voices in his head that aren't his. I mean, we see this. It was the same thing with the shooting that happened, I want to say, at the San Diego base last year. I mean, all of these guys who are very tight-minded individuals. I mean, you don't just go out and get a law degree. Falling apart at the seams and calling out these strange incidents, you know, gang stalking, targeted individuals, electronic stalking, all this kind of wild stuff. And I will guarantee that those are the details that we're not going to hear as the story gets buried. And I'm sure the story will be buried because of Obama's amnesty announcement yesterday. Oh, my goodness, ladies and gentlemen, it has happened. He announced the deferred deportation plan in a nationally televised event last night, taking upon himself powers constitutionally vested in Congress and perhaps setting off a constitutional crisis. And Republicans are up in arms. One of the aides from the Republican side of the aisle said if this amnesty were to happen, that they would literally, conservatives would literally burn Washington to the ground. They were asked to clarify. All he said was, open rebellion. That's what the aides to the GOP party are saying quietly and not so quietly to themselves right now. But Obama insisted that this plan is not amnesty. Okay, amnesty is the immigration system we have today where millions of people who live here without paying their taxes are playing by the rules. That's what he qualified as amnesty. But my opinion is that someone should probably get him a dictionary for Christmas because amnesty really doesn't have anything to do with the quote-unquote immigration system we have today. Amnesty is not punishing illegal immigrants for crossing the border without legal documents, not paying taxes, and not paying by the rules, which is exactly what he is doing, right? And then some interesting points were brought up after this also, and one of which I want to bring out here. When was the last time a U.S. president addressed the nation about something he had decided to do, not something he had done, and had to explain why it was not against the law? Clinton? Nixon? They were defending against past actions, not making policy announcements. You think that an immigration policy announcement delivered in purple prose, quoting scripture no less, would not require a legal disclaimer. But if you listen to the speech last night, there was definitely a legal disclaimer offered. When you have to come out and say, I'm doing this, but it's not against the law. Yeah, that's ridiculous. It has a lot. It's like Lois Lerner saying, I didn't break any laws, and here's 21 indicated separate reasons that I can say why I have. I'm going to declare the fifth, but then I'm going to try and plead my innocence here. So anyway, we're going to go to this 3-minute break, guys. Stick around. We have so many more amazing headlines to come. We'll keep talking about the amnesty. CIA wants to destroy thousands of documents. Let's see. Doctors are still hiding Ebola. Oh my gosh, so much to talk about. Stick right here, your daily dose of deprogramming. My name is JD. We'll be right back, guys. Thanks for sticking with us.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN Worldwide.
Here at MyPatriotSupply.com, our customers are number one. Built on a self-sustaining business model, we don't owe our existence to big banks or big business. Instead, the company was built by you, the customer. The success of My Patriot Supply is a testimony to the loyalty and dedication of each and every one of you, to our old-fashioned values and top-rated customer service. These elements alone have made us the number one choice of patriots everywhere. We believe that being prepared should not be a luxury reserved by people with large disposable incomes, which is why we have the products you need at the prices you can afford. We bring you our Patriot Pantry brand of storable food, which features top-of-the-line flavors and carefully packed to store for 25 years. Plus water purification systems, non-GMO heirloom seeds, survival gear, and much, much more. Visit MyPatriotSupply.com or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule 1 drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
White Buffalo with John Phillips.
Tuesday through Thursdays on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for sticking with us through that break. We are in our second segment of news right now, and we were just talking about this ridiculous amnesty announcement that Barack Obama made yesterday, and wanted to again point out the fact that when you're talking about something that you're going to do in a speech, normally you don't have to apply a legal disclaimer, but that is exactly what happened last night. And the Republicans were quick to jump on this whole thing again, and they used a lot of Obama's words against him in their response. So let's talk about the Republican response to this. They essentially came out and charged Obama with overstepping his constitutional powers a year after declaring that he did not have the authority to act on this on his own. And there's a fantastic video at Truth Stream Media right now, which Mel put together, which puts Barack right next to himself in a video, and it's essentially him chastising himself about not being a king and about not having the power to do this. And then the next video is obviously him deciding that he does have the power to do it and moving forward. It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition there if you don't have the memory that most of us have when you're dealing with all of this stuff. It can be easy to forget that only a year ago, Barack said that he didn't have the power to act on this alone. But in a video released before the Obama's televised speech, Representative Boehner said the president has said before he is not a king and that he's not an emperor, but he is sure acting like one. With 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, Obama's plan would let some 4.4 million who are parents of U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents remain in the country temporarily without the threat of deportation. Those undocumented residents could apply legally for jobs and join American society, but not vote or qualify for insurance under the president's health care law. The measure would apply for those who have been in the United States for at least 5 years, does not include anyone who shows up today, according to the president, and an additional 270,000 people would be eligible for relief under the expansion of a 2012 move by Obama to stop deporting people brought illegally to the United States as children by their parents. And as usual, the president raised a couple of straw men to knock down while accusing Republicans of being heartless monsters. Normal Democratic and liberal tactics of framing everything in a humanitarian issue, which is, of course, what he did last night also. He said trying to deport all 11 million people living in the country illegally was not realistic. And his voice took on a very empathetic tone as he described the struggle of all illegal immigrants to avoid getting deported. He says, I have seen the heartbreak and anxiety of children whose mothers might be taken away from them just because they didn't have the right papers. But it needs to be said that very few Republicans have ever called for the mass deportation of 11 million people, and that's pretty ridiculous and only serves to highlight the president's desperation. But also note that the president's attitude towards the right papers, quote-unquote, as if there was some kind of clerical error that was forcing the illegal immigrants to be deported. What a piece of work this guy is. And finally, the president plays the Brer Rabbit card, don't throw me in the briar patch, Mr. Fox, as Obama urged Republicans not to take steps against his plan that could lead to a government shutdown, raising the specter of a crisis that some conservatives would like to push, but Republican leaders of Congress want to avoid. Republicans were blamed for a shutdown over spending a year ago and are seeking ways to deny funding for Obama's immigration steps without provoking a year-end budget crisis. He goes on to say, this is Obama during his speech, that Congress certainly shouldn't shut down our government again just because we disagree on this. But the president believes that there shouldn't be any consequences for rendering the Constitution moot. But if the GOP were to shut down the government, they would be partying long into the night at the White House. Obama may be channeling Briar Rabbit, but the tar baby of government shutdown would snare Republicans in the trap that Obama is currently setting for them. It hardly matters whose fault it would be, but the media and the president would successfully blame the Republicans. And the Republicans right now are pretty unsure because of that what their next move is going to be. They may take the executive to court. They may try and defund parts of the agencies responsible for implementing Obama's plan. Or they may just simply wait until next year when they have a majority and then take a legislative tack on crippling or eliminating amnesty altogether. But Barack Obama's speech last night was the opening salvo in a war pregnant with meaning and importance. The outcome will determine whether we live in a pseudo-monarchy or a republic. And yes, the Ben Franklin admonishment to the woman who asked him after the Constitutional Convention whether they had decided on a monarchy or a republic rings just as true today. It is a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. And we are on a very slippery slope right now, ladies and gentlemen. Speaking of slippery slope, CIA is back in the news today. They want to destroy thousands of internal emails covering spy operations and other activities. The CIA plan to erase tens of thousands of emails off of its internal servers, including those sent by virtually all covert and counterterrorism officers after they leave the agency, is drawing fire from some intelligence committee members concerned that it would wipe out key records of some of the agency's most controversial operations. The agency's proposal, which has been tentatively approved by the National Archives, could allow for the destruction of crucial documentary evidence regarding the CIA's activities. And this is, of course, according to the Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein and Ranking Minority Member Senator Saxby Chambliss. They wrote in a letter to Margaret Hawkins, who is the Director of Records and Management Services at the Archives. And the source of the controversy may be that the CIA, given its secret mission and rich history of clandestine operations, is not a normal agency. And its proposal to destroy internal emails comes amid mounting tensions between the CIA and its Senate oversight panel, stoked by continued bickering over an upcoming committee report, relying heavily on year-old internal CIA emails. And that internal report is sharply critical of the agency's use of waterboarding and other aggressive interrogation techniques against Al-Qaeda suspects in the aftermath of 9/11. So, I find it interesting that at least the CIA has admitted that they are going to destroy all the documents, as opposed to the IRS, who just did it anyway and then said, oh, we are so stupid, we can't find them. Probably should also be pointed out that there are rules and regulations regarding both of those agencies, the IRS and the CIA, that require you to not only keep a hard copy, and a hard copy means printing it out and putting it in a file, guys, of every email, every single piece of intelligence or every single piece of information that you get. All of those things are to be printed out and kept for posterity indefinitely as far as the law goes. But the IRS has obviously don't care about the law, and probably CIA doesn't either, but at least it's nice that they're telling us what they're going to do before they do it. So I want to move on and talk a little bit about Ferguson right now, because we had some speculation yesterday. I think I mentioned this a couple of days ago, that there was potential that this Ferguson unrest could blow up into other cities, right? We could see Chicago, Detroit, Oakland, places like that. But, I was way wrong. I was way wrong, guys. 83 different cities now have protests scheduled, and they are holding direct action training. Oh my goodness, 83 different cities. You can find this. We have this article up at redpillreports.com under the U.S. news section, or you can search for the title, Ferguson Protests Scheduled for 83 Cities. please do come to the website and check this out, because this is crazy. Everybody knows that the government, with its lapdog mainstream media, is in lockstep, and they have whipped up the Ferguson situation into a total frenzy. Even we've had a report of Barack Obama meeting personally with the protesters and encouraging them to stay the course. Not going to be a good situation, but it doesn't matter what the grand jury decides now. Fear and anger are very powerful weapons, and everybody who has allowed the powers that shouldn't be to steer their emotions on this one has already taken the bait. And now the cops have stoked up on $200,000 worth of riot gear, less lethal ammunition, and the like. Ferguson residents themselves have been advised to go out and get guns because the cops are not going to be able to protect them from what is coming. And the firearm sales in the area have skyrocketed. Everybody in St. Louis right now is on edge. The governor, Jay Nixon, has preemptively declared a 30-day state of emergency and called out the National Guard. And the grand jury decision hasn't even been made yet, you guys. So basically, it's on. It's going to be on in Ferguson. It's on. I mean, I don't know how else to put it other than it's on. Ferguson, however, is not the only city set to hold protests immediately following the Darren Wilson grand jury announcement. Actually, they aren't even being referred to as protests anymore. Now they're being called planned responses. And a Tumblr page for something called the Ferguson National Response Network has posted a very organized list with graphics for each location, which obviously took a lot of time and effort and money to put together. And they detail these planned responses that have been scheduled for a total of 82 cities across the United States and one in Canada after the grand jury announces their decision. And I think we all know which way the wind is going to blow in terms of that grand jury decision. So that, I think, you know, preparedness is the name of the game right now, guys. The organizers have also released a list of 19 proposed rules of engagement. And this is not your average civil disobedience. Martha Stewart has thrown less organized birthday parties in this, and there are White House functions with less planning and training involved than what is going on in this national planned organized response to this Ferguson situation. So guys, if you're out there, you can find this article, you can go back to the source, and it will tell you all of the cities that are involved, but we don't have time to go through them all. It's 83, and there are big ones, and if you're in one of those, that could be a very important piece of information for you to have. Also, relating to this Ferguson thing, the grand jury hearing evidence in the Michael Brown shooting is preparing to meet today for what might be its final session, and a decision on whether or not to charge Officer Darren Wilson could come as early as today, according to law enforcement officers who are briefed on the plans. St. Louis County prosecutors are preparing to present more evidence to the grand jury before they start deliberations, and a decision on an indictment is expected very soon after, according to law enforcement officers again. If a decision comes Friday, prosecutors are expected to provide law enforcement with 48 hours notice before making a public announcement, possibly on Sunday. It's a very good thing that we have a lot of high-ranking people that we know as sources in law enforcement around St. Louis. I went to high school in St. Louis. I know plenty of police officers there. So hopefully, if they do release information to law enforcement by the end of the day, we can get something up for you guys at Red Pill Reports over the weekend, so you guys are ahead of the curve. But that's what is going on right now. Prosecutor Rob McCulloch has said he plans to make public all evidence and testimony presented to the grand jury, but now there's actually growing concern from some on how to deal with the identities of the people who have testified. These concerns have been raised because some of the witnesses could be put at risk once their testimony and identities become public. In some of the cases, witnesses might have testified differently under oath, providing different accounts than the one they gave in media interviews, and others may have provided testimony that could be interpreted as helpful to the officer's account of the August 9 shooting. So there's a lot more going on with this grand jury decision than meets the eye. I can't stress enough how important it is to go and find this article at redpillreports.com and check out the list of cities to make sure that if you are in one of them, that you are prepared. As I said, you know, this decision could be forthcoming as early as today. And if it is today, then we would expect, given that 48-hour window, that the main announcement will be made Monday, if not Sunday night. And, I mean, absolute all heck could break loose Monday morning. So we will keep an eye on that for you. Also, let's see here. What else is important that we want to cover today? The U.S. is going to allow people from nations hit by Ebola to stay in the country temporarily. The Department of Homeland Security will grant temporary protected status to people from three West African countries most affected by Ebola who are currently resided in the United States, according to department officials yesterday. People from Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone in the United States as of Thursday may apply for protection from deportation as well as for work permits for 18 months, according to the Department of Homeland Security. And after 18 months, the Department of Homeland Security will assess whether the protection should be extended based on the level of the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. This move is a response to the Ebola epidemic specifically, which has claimed more than 5,000 lives, mostly in the three West African countries. And in order to prevent mass migration from West Africa to the United States, nationals from these countries who arrive after Thursday will not be eligible for protected status. And the United States reserves temporary protected status for people from countries experiencing conditions deemed too dangerous to return to, such as Haiti, after the 2010 earthquake. So that is what's going on in Ebola in that move. Oh, that's health news. We're in national news right now. I do have health news about Ebola, so we'll get back into that. Also from Red Flag today, articles of impeachment have been written by a constitutional attorney. I'm not going to go through this whole article right now because it is so, so long. But there are so many reasons to impeach Barack Obama at this point. It's staggering stuff. So if you go to, again, redpillreports.com, you'll see this article which outlines the impeachment or the reasons that we need to impeach Barack. So that is up for you to peruse on the website as well. In economic news, what is happening? The Dow is pretty high right now, 17,828, up more than 100 points in the early trading today. Gold made a significant jump back to over $1,200. We're sitting at $1,205 right now. And silver following suit, as it always does, $16.53 for an ounce of silver right now. And the crude oil starting to come back up as well, $76.13 for a barrel of crude right now. And then let's get into some other economic news. Probably the most important one here has to do with Goldman Sachs and their ties to the New York Fed. There's been a new information leak, and according to this leak, from his desk in Lower Manhattan, a banker at Goldman Sachs thumbed through confidential documents courtesy of a source inside the United States government. The banker came to Goldman through the so-called revolving door, a symbolic portal that connects financial regulators to Wall Street. He joined in July after spending 7 years as a regulator at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is the government's front line in overseeing the financial industry. That is not true. That is a lie. There is nothing federal about the Federal Reserve. But anyway, I digress. He received a confidential information, according to lawyers briefed on the subject matter, from a former colleague who was still working at the New York Fed. This previously unreported leak recounts in interviews with the lawyers briefed on the matters who spoke anonymously because obviously this episode is not public and illustrates the blurred lines between Wall Street and the government. Obviously, we'll be speaking a little bit more about that blurred line with Andrew Gauss later today, so I'll save the rest of this for that, but just more information coming out every single day about the collusion between the banking interests and the government, yada, yada, yada. We've been there, we've done that, we've seen it, and we are all being affected by it, so there you go. SpectroCoin launches a Bitcoin to cash service in 25 countries. It is now allowing its customers to convert Bitcoin into cash in 25 different countries around Europe and Central Asia. The announcement is the latest from the UK and Lithuania-based Bitcoin service provider, which added merchant processing to its existing brokerage and wallet offerings back in August. And speaking to CoinDesk, the CEO of SpectroCoin, who has got a name that is literally impossible to pronounce, I don't think it has two vowels in it anywhere. He compared his company's newest service to traditional remittance offering, emphasizing that his company intends to make extending services to the underbanked in its region a core focus. So he's saying that in some countries they don't need this very much, but in Russia and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, Belarus, Armenia, and lots of other countries, it's a really useful service because there are a lot of unbanked people there and the banking infrastructure is not very easy to develop. So now people can get funds really easily and actually use Bitcoin as a remittance. So Bitcoin being back in the news again with some good news, I think, as we see it expanding more and more. Obesity has become a $2 trillion weight on the global economy, which is obviously still struggling to rebound from the financial crisis. And put another way, the obesity crisis now costs 2.8% of the world's gross domestic product. And that, he said in the report, we're talking, the study was released by McKinsey and Company. And then talking about this report, they said it's roughly equivalent to the global impact from smoking or armed violence, war, and tourism. More than 2.1 billion people are overweight and obese. And he said that's about 30% of the population, but it's also some 2.5 times those deemed undernourished. And he says this obesity problem is getting worse. It's a major drag on the economy and is probably now outranking war and outranking a whole bunch of other things, alcoholism, what else? Smoking, armed violence, war, terrorism, obesity. Big, big deal. Big, big deal. In economic terms, you guys. So that's also happening right now. The U.S. has pumped the most oil since it has in the 1980s. Falling oil prices haven't taken the wind out of U.S. oil producers just yet. Weekly data from the Energy Information Administration on Thursday showed U.S. production totaled 9.06 million barrels a day in the week ending the 7th of November, which is the highest level since the 1980s. And that appeared to overshadow the unexpected drawdown in weekly crude supplies, with traders sending the NYMEX WTI crude futures briefly below $75 a barrel and the lowest trade for most active futures contracts since September of 2010. We did just mention that oil has started to bump back up. Have we seen the end of the bear market on oil and gold? I don't know. We'll have to talk to Andrew about that in the next hour. And then in some more surprising news coming out of Germany, Commerzbank hits its customers now with negative interest rates. Oh my goodness. So here we go again. Commerzbank, which is Germany's second largest lender, announced yesterday that it will start charging large corporate customers and institutional investors to hold high levels of deposits on their accounts. However, individual private customers and small to medium-sized businesses will not be affected, according to the bank. They say they reserve the right to charge some large corporates a fee on parked liquidity above a certain threshold. And the move comes following a decision by the European Central Bank in June to take its key interest rates into the negative territory for the first time. The ECB slapped a negative interest rate on bank deposits placed overnight at the central bank, meaning financial institutions must pay to keep their surplus reserves there. And the ECB hoped that the move would persuade banks to lend the money onto private sectors rather than parking it at the central bank. And in September, the ECB moved the rate deeper into the negative territory, cutting it to minus 0.2%. One of the risks of this negative interest rate is that banks may attempt to recoup the extra cost from their customers, and Commerzbank says it would encourage large clients to shift extra cash to alternative investments. Negative interest rates are highly controversial in Germany, where households and many companies prefer dull but stable savings accounts to investing in the stock market or bond market. So negative interest rates happening across Europe. And it just blows my mind. I wonder what the agenda is behind that, because obviously they're trying to keep money out of the banks right now, and they're trying to encourage these people. I mean, are we seeing a corporate run or a corporate-induced bank run? I mean, is that what this is going to result? Why would you keep money in the bank if it costs you money to keep it there? It doesn't make any sense to me. So there is that going on in the economy as well. I'm going to get away from that and try and get into some tech news here for you quickly, guys, because more important stuff happening there now. Big story from Russia today, and I can't get through the whole thing, but the NSA, the head of the NSA, has finally come out and warned Congress yesterday that China and probably one or two other nations currently possess the capability to cripple the American power grid through cyber attacks. And of course, we've talked about this a lot. We know that the SHIELD bill, which would have settled all of this, has been dead in committee since about 2008. So this is not a new issue. It's just new that the NSA has finally come out and agreed that it actually is a concern. And speaking before the House Intelligence Committee Thursday morning, Admiral Michael Rogers, the top official at both the NSA and the United States Cyber Command, said that major systems like infrastructure that provide power to houses and facilities across the country could be taken offline by state-sponsored attackers from abroad. And certain nations are regularly performing electronic renaissances in their culture, according to Rogers, in an effort to be well-placed within a utility system in the event that the networks relied on by chemical facilities or water treatment plants or other critical infrastructure components are ordered to be taken offline by foreign governments. And leading officials within the American intelligence community and Congress have long warned about the potential catastrophic repercussions if such networks should happen to be penetrated and pulverized by foreign actors with malicious intent. But Rogers' remarks this week are among the most dire ever, not just from an individual well-placed in the administration, but from a person arguably most qualified to testify as much. He says, we are watching multiple nations invest in this capability, and this is part of his warning, and in that warning he specifically named China as one of these nations that is rapidly approaching the capability to shut down our grid, ladies and gentlemen. So Rogers, who is a cryptology expert with decades-long career in the U.S. Navy, replaced General Keith Alexander as head of Cyber Command and the NSA back in April, less than a year after the latter first became subject of an international scandal with former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, and started supplying journalists with classified information about secret surveillance programs in the United States and its allies. The NSA's chief's comments on Thursday came mostly in response to questions from another Mike Rogers, who is the Republican congressman from Michigan, who currently chairs the House committee and has long campaigned for new rules concerning both offensive and defensive cyber operations. So startling revelations coming out from the NSA right now, essentially saying that we are under threat of a global of a national grid down situation because of malicious intent from other people. And I think that, you know, we know that. We've talked about that. That's probably one of the largest threats that exists to us right now. Interesting that the NSA is coming out and saying it right now. So, let's get into this other story. Firefighters, cops, and soldiers could have access now to jetpacks after a groundbreaking deal with a New Zealand inventor. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it's 2014. I expected a jetpack at least 15 years ago. And in a world where we barely have a hoverboard, I mean, there's like a miniature magnetic hoverboard that you can't do an ollie on. I'm so disappointed. I'm so disappointed with technology. But firefighters, cops, and soldiers are now going to have access to jetpacks, and they think they will be going on sale in 2016. They are working closely with the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense to bring these really radical jetpacks to law enforcement and rescue organizations across our country. It's a carbon-based frame. It's got 200 horsepower petrol engines on it. It can carry 120 kilograms and fly up to 74 kilometers an hour for 30 minutes at altitudes of 1,000 meters, and it's completely autonomous. Controlled by a pilot navigating with two joysticks. Very, very cool stuff coming out of New Zealand. Lots and lots of tech news I didn't get to today. The largest solar farm in Africa became fully operational. Big time news there. Anyways, guys, I apologize. We got lots of news I couldn't get to. Please go to redpillreports.com. Check out the show section and you will see all the news I couldn't get to. Keep with us here through this 3-minute break, guys. Andrew Gauss is going to be joining us as our guest. We're going to be talking about the shadow banking system, fractional reserve lending, the history and future of commerce, the history and future of what is money? I don't know. We'll find out in a minute with Andrew. Stay right here, guys.
Joe Joseph here for Truth Frequency Radio. According to allgov.com, since 9/11, a total of 238 Americans have died from a terrorist attack. That's 24 a year, making your chance of dying 1 in 625,000. Conversely, you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of becoming a victim of police brutality. Yet we spend trillions of dollars on the war on terror while militarizing an abusive police force. At TruthFrequencyRadio.com, we have a team of the very best personalities in independent media. A team that's dedicated to bringing you reliable and rock-solid news and information so you can arm yourself with knowledge and join the fight against worldwide oppression and tyranny. Truth Frequency Radio. News without the hate, hype, and fear.
Hey, Big Mouth. Yeah, you. Listen, I want you to put the word out on the street. Tell your co-workers, your family, your paisanos, that my good friend, Joe Joseph, is doing a good thing. He's sticking his neck out for me, for Syl, and for all the people in the world. Isn't that right, Syl?
He's part of the family now, Deej.
That's what I thought. So tune in to him right here on Freedom Link, Monday to Friday, exclusively on the Truth Frequency Radio. Yeah, they're watching you. Big deal. They're watching me, too. They're watching everybody. So grow some cojones and give them something to watch and listen to. Make them earn it. Give them paperwork until they choke. That's right. I know you won't let me down. So you're going to put the word out about my good friend, Joe Joseph, right? Good. Now do me a favor and get out of here.
Sure, I'm glad I tried that new Iodine Now microplant powder formulation.
You liked it, huh? I told you it would change your life.
Yeah, I feel fantastic, and I have so much more energy.
Hi, I have your Iodine Now delivery.
Oh, yes, my second order arrived. Thank you so much.
Hey, buddy, why don't you ask this lady out for a date?
Good idea. Now that I'm taking Iodine Now, I have the energy to enjoy my life again.
It looks like you're getting back your old charm, buddy.
I'd love to go out to dinner with you. And can I try some of the iodine now?
Of course you can. You just delivered me a 1-year supply.
Your future looks really great.
I finally agree with you.
Iodine Now, part of the Microplant Powder family. Microplant Powder is available in 15 different formulations. Call 888-910-4367 or visit the website to find the one that's right for you. And listen to our new audio descriptions for every product only at MFUSA.org.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
The Wicked Ones, obviously under heavy Masonic influence.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. This is your daily dose of deprogramming, and we are moving into our second hour. We do this every day, Monday through Friday, live from 10 o'clock Central until noon Central. And during the second hour, we always have a fantastic guest. Today is absolutely no exception to that rule, ladies and gentlemen. It is my esteemed privilege to be introducing all of you to Mr. Andrew Gauss today. Now, Andrew, for those of you who don't know, is a nationally recognized U.S. monetary historian and numismatic expert. He's also been appraising the Americans about the pitfalls of our electronic banking transactions and the institution of Big Brother as we move into this cashless society. He has been studying and lecturing on the problems and solutions connected to our monetary system for more than 2 decades. He also tackles the challenging questions about America's real economic future and provides behind-the-scenes insight as to how the politicians and bankers in D.C. plan to secretly deal with the debt crisis and how their plan will be catastrophic for every American taxpayer. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Red Pill Reports today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, absolutely. As you know, a lot of people out there that are listeners to the show know that the economic issue in our country is at the forefront of our minds almost all the time. You know, as we all line up every 15th of April to pay our dues, as it were, and people obviously growing more and more concerned about where that money is going off to. But before we get into all that, and before we start talking about the wonderment, the eighth wonder of the world, which is fractional reserve lending, as far as I'm concerned, and the shadow banking system, I want to know if you would, if you don't mind, give us a little bit more insight into your background, how you got invested in this so heavily in terms of your study of the economy. How did all that begin for you, and what are some of the other important things that we should know about you before we get into this discussion?
Well, I have to date myself in order to do that, right? So, I was a paper boy in the late, middle 60s.
Okay.
And, I delivered newspapers. That was my gig. Mm-hmm. And that's when they changed the money. You know, when you're president history, it's a very, it's an alarming thing. Well, you don't know it at the time, but all the different forms of money that people were paying me with, silver certificates, U.S. notes, silver coins, and then, of course, we had the Johnson problem when they outlawed silver ownership. They took the silver out of coins and replaced it with clad coinage. Then they withdrew the silver certificates, and then they eliminated the United States notes. And as I got a little older, 1971, President Richard Nixon closed the gold window on my birthday in 1971.
Happy birthday.
So I've always felt closely tied to this numismatic question of what our money was. And my grandfather's an uncle, my grandfather on my father's side, and my uncle primarily, my father's brother, told me about how they had gold coins. Grandpa was a tobacco farmer, and, you know, the old silver dollars and the $20 gold pieces and $10 and $5 gold pieces, which they had managed to hold on to through the Depression.
Wow.
And I was fascinated with these things, and it occurred to me that the value of money traveled with money. And it wasn't a representation of someone else's obligation, but rather a thing of substance in and of itself. So never mind the artwork on the $20 St. Gaudens, which is probably the most beautiful coin ever made, but the fact that it contained an ounce of gold, you know, that's what gave it its substance. It wasn't someone else's promise to pay or required. You got the money, it was your money, period. Mm-hmm. And that big sea change, I think, I became more acutely aware as a young man in the 77 to 80 period when inflation just ate away at the substance of everything everyone earned, everything everyone saved, and it was all because the money had no substance. To me, it was a direct correlation of the closing of the gold window by Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And that was it. After 77, I think, I became an ardent supporter of sound money, followed Harry Brown and the first libertarian presidential campaign. And mm-hmm. Boy, those were the good old days. I must out to Wayne now. In the meantime, I started building collections for prominent individuals who had, you know, excess paper money. Mm-hmm. And I started to become aware of electronic money, the nature of money, and started studying the Fed and continued my study of numismatics. And then in 1996, so actually I made a series of predictions for the coming decade in 1990, which was widely picked up in the press. I think 10 things that were going to change about your money. Mm-hmm. And then next thing you know, I was on television and radio. And in 96, I put together The Secret World of Money, mm-hmm. Which is a little question and answer book. And then in 2003, followed that up with Uncle Sam Cook's The Books. And then by 2005, I threw my hands up in disgust. The idea that we would have some collective action to change all of this was beyond the pale.
Right.
That it was my duty to kind of grab every citizen by his lapels and make individually empowered Americans, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's in that vein that we invited you here today. I love this conversation, to be perfectly honest, because I think that there are still so many things that are hidden in terms of, I mean, I know where to go to find what's the journal that the Fed put out in 1910 about fractional reserve lending, Modern Money Mechanics. You know, I've read
Modern Money Mechanics at the Chicago Fed. Yeah, thank you, Internet. This is another thing.
Exactly.
You know, and I urge people to go to source material all the time. Mm-hmm. So if you want information about the Fed, go to the Fed.
Absolutely.
If you want information about the Treasury, go to the Treasury. Mm-hmm. Don't listen to someone else's filter, you know, what they've interpreted as the data, but get the data yourself.
I agree with that. But then, so my question then is, after 20 years of being so involved with the study of this economic system, are there still things out there that it surprises you that people are just, that don't care about or are not aware of?
Well, no, because I must say, in the beginning, I always thought, well, look, when I found out that the Fed privately owned institutions, and this was in the early 70s, all right, I became convinced that, boy, if Americans just understood that these guys were private for-profit enterprise and that it wasn't the Treasury that was issuing the money, that would be enough.
Yeah.
And, man, I tell you, I've never seen which is worse, ignorance or apathy. I don't know. And I don't care. That seemed to be the rallying cry. And I walked through the hallways of Congress with a congressman, you know, they do walk with me, right? And I'm walking, and my question was, but congressman, the Constitution, Article 1 says, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And with that, he stopped in his tracks and looked at me and says, "It still says that?" This was our elected officials. So, yeah. So, oh. This was, of course, the 70s.
Right.
And then there's one little clip running around on YouTube with me and a guy named DeLoe Smith from the Conference Board. I think it's from the early 90s, which I said, "The Federal Reserve creates money." And she's like, "Baloney." That was his response. How does the Federal Reserve create money? I said, "Well, first they introduce the debt instrument, and then they create the monetary influence to back it up." Mm-hmm. No, they don't. A complete denial that this was how the monetary system works. So Right. This is, people don't know, and I don't think they care. So ignorance and apathy both have taken over the monetary knowledge of the world.
Well, isn't it amazing that complacency seems to be what makes the world go round these days? I mean, my God.
Well, yeah, they get their bank statement, and the numbers are either the same or bigger than the month before, and so that is enough to satisfy them. No one stops to look behind the curtain and say, "Well, what is the substance of this unit, this Federal Reserve accounting unit dollar, right?
This is
what we use. What is it?" They don't know. I mean, you hear people say, "A dollar isn't what it used to be," right?
Right.
But they never say a quart isn't what it used to be,
right?
Or a gallon isn't what it used to be. It's like, it's a unit of measure. You're supposed to know what it is. And if you don't, then how can you conduct your affairs? This is what puzzles me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess, my question then is, is there any place on the, let's define the difference between money and currency first, and we'll figure out,
sure,
what do we have? Do we have money? Do we have currency? You know, what is it that we've got in this country? So let's start there. What's the difference between money and currency, or is there one, and is there a distinction that needs to be made between what we should be carrying and what we're actually carrying?
Yeah, or what we're storing. And that distinction, currency, right? I mean, it, the way people think of it, currency, they think of the paper form of the monetary unit, that unit of measure.
Right.
But it isn't, really. It's currency refers to money that is current for payment, or it can be electronic, it can be paper, or it can be coin.
Okay.
But the definition of what a dollar is, that's something that you really have to dig for. And understanding that we shifted from commodity money to fiduciary money.
Ah.
And understanding that shift, everyone wants to refer to it as fiat, right, by edict.
Right.
But have fiat money that actually has substance, right? So, by fiat, the Congress or President can say, "Hey, only gold is money," right?
Right.
And then by fiat, that's what it means, by edict, mm-hmm, gold becomes money. So it's not fiat money that we should be opposed to. It's fiduciary money, where the representation of what money is all that you get. So all that all of us have are claims for money. And the way that Eustace Mullins put it, and I tend to agree with him, is so we went into the gold and silver that is our money, right? Gold and silver coin. Congress sets the unit of measure. A dollar is 0.7734 ounces of silver, or 1/20th of an ounce of gold. Now, you're free to issue notes at commercial law. I owe you dollars and as many notes as you want. And if people want to accept those notes and actually transfer them amongst themselves as money, that's, of course, their business. That is, in fact, a big business. It's how Goldman Sachs got started. So you're going to sell me a bale of cotton, and you're going to give me an IOU, and then Goldman is going to take it at a discount and give you current money, and then he is the holder of that note. Well, the realization that notes can be replaced as money came to us in 33, 34, really, with the stock market crash in 29 and then the outlawing of the private ownership of gold. So essentially the president said, "We're going to take all the gold coins and we're going to put them in a pile here in Fort Knox, and then we're going to issue these notes, because if we just let people issue notes, then they're going to willy-nilly issue more notes than they can ever pay, and that's what causes the system to collapse." In fact, that is the system of banking that we have today, the inability to cash the note. And as long as you can't cash the note, then the system can, it's like a game of musical chairs where the music never stops.
Mm-hmm.
You just continue. No one ever gets to redeem them for the money, and the system can go on as long as there are zeros to inject.
Mm-hmm. And would you, I mean, I classify it as a Ponzi scheme just given interest. I mean, if they're only going to create the amount of the principal and they're not going to create extra money to cover the interest, then that interest has to come from someplace, which means the entire system is designed for some people to fail, right? Which inherently...
It keeps a constant draw. Exactly right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, do you consider the money scheme, this financial, you know, system that we're in right now, to be a Ponzi scheme?
You know, to quote Archibald Roberts, Ponzi was a piker. You know, he's an amateur compared to these guys.
Right.
I mean, they, you know, Social Security, I would definitely qualify as a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
The system, what we have to call Dollar Inc., right? Because that's what they've developed, a brand, yes? You know, a Dollar Inc. is the model. And there are many Dollar Inc. Brand, right? You have the Federal Reserve, which absolutely is the roost. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Bundesbank, the Bank of Japan, which the Fed effectively took over after World War II. Mm-hmm. And so you have several other outposts, and guys all cooperate through these entities, G20, G10, and so on. So they all get together and decide, you're inflating your currency, I'm inflating mine. Hey, you can't issue more currency because you don't have enough people. So before you can issue currency, you have to line up your taxpayers and give them all a number and show us what their income is going to be, and that's your anticipated revenue. Okay, well then you have 200 million people and they all have numbers and they're all working. You've enumerated them all, so we know who they are. Okay, then you can issue another 200 million in currency.
See, because what like you just said was that that what backs our money in this supposed fiat system is the population itself, their future time, talent, and energy. Is that in fact what you're saying right now?
Well, yeah, but you have to go further because you can't just have a bunch of people sitting around under a tree doing nothing.
Right.
Right? They must be productive, and that production must be measured, and that measured and taxed. And then taxed according to a formula, and that formula must be known so that we can, it's just like if you go to a bank and you say, I have this apartment building and it throws off this much income, mm-hmm. right? And I want to borrow this much money. So the bank says, okay, we're going to put a lien on the apartment building and then we're going to give you the equivalent money that the apartment building is worth, and then every month you give us the rent, which you're going to collect. Well, I mean, that, transfer that concept to the human being, and the bank is now the International Monetary Fund, which determines everyone's level of participation. So all the different countries, if one country is inflating their currency beyond their ability to monitor and pay, then that damages the other countries, and it makes the whole system suspect. So in order to keep the system operating promptly, there must be rules that need to be followed.
Okay.
I'll give you a classic example. If you ever go to a carnival, right, and you go up to play, some of the games are rigged, believe it or not.
Only some of them, really?
Only some of them, right? Okay, so the game is rigged, and you pay your $2 and you spin the thing or, you know, pop the balloon, whatever it is you have to do in order to win the big teddy bear. Now, because the game is rigged, no one could ever really win a teddy bear unless the operator of the game wants them to. And in the way that they merchandise, to give the game a good name, is if the teddy bear costs $10 and it's $5 a game, then every fourth game we're going to give away a teddy bear. Not because we have to, but because we want to. We want to instill confidence in the system. Mm-hmm. So using the rigged game, they can build confidence in something that's obviously rigged. And have a merchandising system that's bar none, right? People walking around with big teddy bears, where'd you win that? Over there. So the participation has to be regulated. Otherwise, if they just took money all day and never gave out a teddy bear, eventually no one would play the game.
That's true.
And this is what the system is structured for confidence nation to nation, and these rules about how many people are working, how much tax you're collecting, that's the limit to which you can inflate your currency this year. Well established, well documented, and as long as they're followed, then the game of musical chairs continues.
Hmm. You know, but this makes me wonder about Barack Obama's amnesty agenda then, because that what you're just saying now is if we can include 11 million more people, well, heck, that's a huge labor and tax rate. Now we can create more money out of nothing, right?
Precisely.
Unreal.
Precisely. Yeah, the old five-finger word, greed, here. I mean, to think for a moment that the president has an ounce of concern, well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe he does.
He might have an ounce.
But to think that his motivation is for the welfare of these 11 million people, I think would miss the agenda altogether. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that with this many new documented taxpayers, then, yes, the money supply is free to expand by an equivalent amount.
Oh, man, that's just crazy, because I think that a lot of people have missed that angle of the agenda. And until you really understand that, you know, your labor, your time, talent, and energy are really the only thing of value on the planet, and that that has been collateralized by these crazy, you know, psychopathic bankers to float our whole country. Until you understand that, it's difficult to make that connection between bringing all these immigrants in, I think.
Yeah, no, and I don't mind the concept. Listen, I'm okay with that idea, because it is our collective time, talent, and brains, right, that gives us, nation its value.
Yes.
Bottom line. Mm-hmm. And so the only problem that I have with it is harnessing that energy and turning it over to private interests.
Right.
For their monopoly use. If we were using it the way that it was intended, like, for example, the First Bank of the United States, now I differ as to whether or not this was even constitutional for Congress to do, but the shares of the First Bank, over half, belonged to the people through the Treasury.
Really?
Until, of course, until they convinced them to sell it. Now, so between revenues from central banking activity and the tariffs, this was known as the American Plan, and I guess until probably 1808, this was a wonderful thing. And, I mean, it gave us the growth of a nation, because it harnessed that energy for the good of the people.
Right.
So I don't mind my energy being harnessed to improve the nation. I don't like it being harnessed to enrich private banks. So my whole problem with the Federal Reserve System is not that it's a fractional reserve system. I can adjust my patterns to suit that. Mm-hmm. So obviously, there are ways to fight inflation. No one's forcing you to store your wealth in Federal Reserve notes. You can store them in what the Constitution defines as money easily. Mm-hmm. So you're not forced to hold them. It is that this energy is being harnessed for private use. If you want to have a Federal Reserve, fine. Take it, lock, stock, and barrel, move it into the Treasury. Any profits that inure to the institution stay in the Treasury. Mm-hmm. Then I'm okay with the system.
And how different is the system that we see now? Like, who all is benefiting from this as opposed to us?
Well, obviously, the owners of the Fed, you know, they get a 6% guaranteed dividend on their paid-in capital.
Are you 6%?
Yeah, 6. Where can you get 6? And if you can get 6 tax-free, now it's more like 9.
Yeah.
Because remember, the earnings of the Federal Reserve Bank and its owners are exempt from taxation. Right. No income tax there. So the IRS has no jurisdiction.
That sounds like a great job if you can get it, you know.
It is. And then, of course, the revelations of the last few days where the former Fed staffer working at Goldman got inside information. You know, there is no firewall between the Federal Reserve and the owners of the Fed. And I know there's been this bogus list floating around the Internet, put it together in 83, but I put a more updated list of who owns the Federal Reserve probably 2 years ago, and it should be easy to find. But the reality is that, you know, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, these institutions pretty much run the show. And, you know, the very same guys, if you get a list of who got the bailout, the TARP money, mm-hmm. that's your list of owners of the Fed, essentially, the controlling interests. And so they are the ones that, you know, decide and make monetary policy, not the elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
And they benefit by their inside deals, like, they bought all the mortgage-backed certificates. You remember those mortgage-backed securities that were
100 pennies on the dollar. For 100 pennies on the dollar, they bought them all.
Right, but the institutions such as Bank of America, JP, and Goldman bought them at 30 cents on the dollar mm-hmm. in the open marketplace, you know, right after the Bear Stearns debacle and right after the Lehman bankruptcy. So when Merrill Lynch went west, they dumped their entire mortgage-backed security portfolio on the market at 32 cents. And you're right, the Fed bought them all from JP and Goldman and the others for 100 cents on the dollar. No negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
So it is that they create, and then if you talk about the synthesis of the mortgage-backed security, you take $1 million worth of mortgages, you bundle them into securities that are somehow now worth $2 million.
Right.
Sell them for $2 million, and that extra million, that's what caused the mortgage crisis, not somebody's inability to pay their mortgage, but the air, the commissions and fees that were packed into the mortgage-backed securities. Right. Otherwise, they would have just sold mortgages.
I have to tell you, too, and this is kind of a side note, but we have a guest that's going to be on Thanksgiving for an hour and a half. His name is Greg Morse. I don't know if you've been following any of our story regarding Greg and his other research assistant, Scott Bennett, but they have got literally the smoking gun evidence on this mortgage security fraud that's happened. Not only can they show without a doubt that 90% of the mortgages that are out there are not, there's no clear chain of title, but Scott Bennett, who is a military intelligence analyst, can actually locate and has located accounts at one bank, which was UBS in the UK, had a minimum of 19,000 different savings accounts that this profit money was funneled through and then went to organizations like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and things like that. And these guys actually have the smoking gun evidence linking all of those events together. So the collusion at Wall Street and with these federal banks is so much bigger, I think, than people even know. Have you heard anything about any of that stuff?
The fact is, I mean, I disagree with the 90% figure. It's really more like 64.
Okay.
But still, that's a big number.
That's huge.
And when you look at the settlements that the banks have paid to avoid prosecution, understand that they can buy lawyers by the score.
Right.
And when they're going to pay billions, tens of billions of dollars to avoid prosecution, you know how long they could pay lawyers for with that kind of money?
Yes. Right? Forever.
Right. So
yeah.
it's not that they don't want to fight. It's that they know they're guilty and they're caught red-handed. No question about it. And no evidence would surprise me. What does surprise me is, what Carol Quigley referred to in Tragedy and Hope, when he said, when they finally remove the velvet glove from the iron fist, when they get to the point where they say, yeah, so what? We don't care.
Right.
And they slam their hand down with an iron fist. That's when you know where you are. And I gotta say, we've been handled with kid gloves, velvet gloves, for the last 70 years. And I believe finally we've reached the point where government is removing that velvet glove and putting down that iron fist. Because when you look at rulings already that have said, okay, we see that the chain of title is broken in that mortgage. You've pointed it out to us. It's clear and crystal clear as day, but we're going to allow the foreclosure to move forward. And this, it's like, okay, we know that we broke the law. We know the law was broken, but we're going to rule against you anyway. That's the iron fist, and I believe Americans are going to get a good dose of it going forward.
Wow. What an amazing discussion. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as I mentioned earlier, we're speaking with Andrew Gauss right now. Just financial genius as far as I'm concerned. And we are going to have to jump to a 3-minute break. This is the bottom of the hour break, so we'll be gone for about 3 minutes. When we come back, though, I'd like to talk to you, Andrew, about the debt crisis that's going on right now, the derivatives, the outstanding derivative markets, which is a bigger number than I can. I don't even know if I have a big enough screen to put all the zeros together, and possibly also about the future of money. We get into Bitcoin and things like that. So stick with us, ladies and gentlemen. 3-minute break. We'll be right back. This is your daily dose of deprogramming. Keep it right here, guys.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio, right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN, worldwide.
In an emergency situation, would you drink contaminated water? You could if you had the amazing Life Straw from MyPatriotSupply.com. Life Straw is the most advanced personal water filter available today. It filters contaminated water from almost any source. Life Straw is lightweight and compact, perfect for hiking, camping, or in an emergency like a flood. Life Straw is easy to clean, comes with a one-year warranty, and has been used worldwide since 2005. Get the amazing Life Straw personal water filter at MyPatriotSupply.com. Plus, check out Survival Seed Vault, 20 seed varieties for only $37.95, Tattler canning lids, long-term storable foods as low as $69.95, and much more at MyPatriotSupply.com. Enjoy stress-free shipping on all orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927 or visit MyPatriotSupply.com. That's 866-229-0927, MyPatriotSupply.com, for emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence.
Since our founding in 2005, we at YouTube have continually strived to bring you the best possible video experience on the internet. But now, we're updating YouTube to make it even better and give our users more of what they want. Introducing YouTube Plus, the new and improved version of YouTube.
Advertising, I mean user experience, has always been our number one priority on YouTube. Recently, we've noticed that there is an abundance of clear white blank space in the margins of each page of YouTube. So we asked ourselves, why don't we fill these with bright, flashy ads? Now, every page will have full-size ads on the edges, and they may or may not be relevant to the videos you're watching. These ads might be unsavory enough to make you want to hide your screen from your parents, but that's what makes YouTube Plus all the more interactive.
'Cause what are you gonna do? Switch to Vimeo? YouTube Plus, what are you gonna do about it?
We hold these truths to be self-evident, and that all men are created equal.
The Freedom Link.
With Joe Joseph, Monday through Friday, on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast for the 21st day of November. We are entering into our final segment right now, and we are knee-deep in a fantastic discussion with the one and only Andrew Gauss. He is a nationally recognized U.S. monetary historian and a numismatic expert, and we are kind of picking his brain about economic policy and about the state of commerce and the state of currency in our country right now, and it is a great pleasure to have him joining us today. And Andrew, before the break, we had talked about a lot of things, what value our money actually has, where that value came from, but we had kind of started to broach into the subject of the collusion between the Federal Reserve, the government, and Wall Street. And I'm wondering, how far back, in your opinion, does that collusion go, or has it always just been a permanent feature?
Yeah, back to the days of, you know, the Buttonwood Exchange, where they were trading out on the street, effectively. The collusion between, you know, Wall Street and Washington, well documented. First Bank of the United States, 1792. I don't think the ink was dry. And we were already chartering the First Bank of the United States and Bank of New York, which were Alexander Hamilton's cronies. And then from that moment forward, the influence of Wall Street in the Treasury is well documented. You know?
Has it gotten worse as they've gotten more technologically advanced? I mean, are they at a point right now where they completely own the entire financial system?
Well, that's inevitable. The banker in the monopoly game. Essentially, we're right. So if we go through monetary history, we see the first bank, privately owned, obviously, owned partially by the people, partially by the British investors. They had the monopoly power to issue money, but only gold and silver were money. So no one else had a charter to issue notes, only the Bank of the United States and the Bank of New York.
Okay.
So people could bring their coin in deposit, and tax deposits and so forth came in, and the bank would issue these bank notes to represent. Now, people always suspected notes, then they had gold and silver to back them up. I mean, that's been the feature. Then with the First Bank's charter expired, obviously, those that understood the circumstance knew that the bank, First Bank United States, had issued more notes than they had money to back it up, and then use these notes to buy anything of substance or value. And so they decided, rightly so, I think Madison did in 1812, not to renew the charter. And the real power behind the banks revealed themselves when the British attacked. Mm-hmm. And 1814, we suddenly agree, okay, we'll recharter the second bank, and the British withdrew and went back to their, which had been influenced by the banks 100 years before.
Right.
So we had any experience with them.
So it's essentially an old hat for these guys at this point.
A very old hat.
Okay.
Yeah. The Bank of England was 1694, and, you know, it was the policies of the Bank of England that caused the revolution, not tax.
Right. A lot of people don't know that. I'm glad you brought that up. I want to ask you a question about fractional reserve lending as it relates to the announcements coming from the European banks to move into negative interest rates for large depositors. And maybe we should back up and define fractional reserve lending for those of us who don't know what it is out there. So if we could start with that. But then it seems to me, given my understanding of fractional reserve lending, that you wouldn't want to start having people pull money out of your bank. But maybe I'm confused about that. Can you clarify some of that for us?
Well, it's only if money has substance, right? If there is some limit to what it is that you are lending. And so then it becomes a problem. So in the days of the, let's look at it when it was gold coins. So you had 10 $20 gold pieces in your vault, and you issue 15 or 20 $20 bills.
Okay.
On the logic that they're not all going to come back at once and ask for the gold coins. Mm-hmm. That's essentially fractional reserve banking, right?
Okay.
So the danger in that system is that more than 10 people come back and ask for the $20 gold pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're left with notes outstanding and nothing of substance to back them up. The idea of homogenizing the money is what gives them the ability to move forward. Now fast forward, 34, now the ownership coming into the bank and ask is no longer allowed. Now you have to take these paper notes and pretend that they are the gold.
Oh.
So now the banker has no limit, effectively, to how many notes he can create. He just wants to maintain confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he doesn't have to worry that he doesn't have 10 $20 gold pieces. He's just free to issue as many notes as he sees fit in his business activity. And the only ability that the consumer has is their ability to go into the bank and say, give me my money in paper.
Right.
Right. And so my book entry says I have $1 million bank, but in paper, they don't have $1 million in cash. Oh, goodness, what do we do? Now, normally, this is really the same problem as gold. So if you look at the H41 release of the Federal Reserve, you'll see collectively, MZM, we all think we have $13 trillion in the bank. I'm not talking about in stocks or in our houses.
Right.
I'm talking our collective checking and savings accounts. $13 trillion.
Right.
Well, the money supply in terms of printed coin and cash is $1.04 trillion. That's like a 5% cover.
Right.
If just 5% of the people went into the bank and said, I want to turn my electronic money into cash, they're done for.
Wow.
The banks don't have, there's not cash to pay everyone.
Right.
So what would they do in that instance? They would simply print more. So I used to keep a solace in my head that, well, as long as they don't run out of trees, they could always pay everyone. we're an electronic monetary system where withdrawing money from a bank doesn't mean anything anymore. So if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, you'll see that the banks collectively have accumulated $2.6 trillion in excess reserves that they have on deposit at the Fed. Now, if someone were to come into the bank or electronically come into the bank and say, give me my $1 million, they would have no trouble simply drawing from the Fed's pile and paying them off.
Right.
So the bank runs that we used to think of are not as big a danger now as they were when there was a physical, actual thing that the banks had to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sitting down on a keyboard and typing in a bunch of zeros, that's no big deal.
Right.
So that has made the system so much easier for them to manage that it's frightening how far they can inflate the currency now.
Mm-hmm. Well, this thing about this negative interest rates that bugs me, though, is that if you're you know, forcing consumers or businesses to not store their wealth with you overnight, then aren't you then cutting into your own ability to lend, given the fractional reserve system?
Goodness, no. In fact, here's the way I explain it. It's, why would they pay anything at all for your money when they could simply create it for free? You know, why pay you interest at all? And here's the bigger question. When there's no alternative and you must have an account in order to conduct business,
right?
Now is the time that they're charging you your electronic, your storage fee, rather, mm-hmm. for storing your electronic money. You know, in the old days, hey, what the heck? I would just take the silver dollars and bury them in the yard. That's what I wanted to do anyway.
Right.
But now that there is no substance to money, of course we're heading for a no interest on money environment. Of course. In fact, the idea that storing money, it will be completely obsolete by 2020. You won't want to keep any electronic money. You'll want to convert it into any other source.
Wow. So you see that then spreading like wildfire across the rest of the planet then?
I absolutely do indeed, yeah. And you know, the idea that your money wouldn't be working, this is what the problem is now. Mm-hmm. It's constant demand for money working. You know, you pull out your smartphone and you log into your bank account. At the moment you log into your bank account, that's when those numbers have to be in that account.
Right.
The moment you log out, that money can be swiftly swept into a bigger master account and put right back to work.
Ah.
So, you know, that the bank didn't have that ability just 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And 100 years ago, the vault armored truck had to come and get the money and move it to someplace. It was very cumbersome, lots of friction.
Right.
You know, the 9/11 attacks, they tell us it was a strike at the heart of the financial system. I had written an article in 91, The River of Money. I think it should still be available online. It talked about the World Trade Center where all the money was. So all the small banks in the United States would wire their money overnight. Okay, my client is asleep and here's his money. Send it to Hong Kong and put it to work. Mm-hmm. That's the main function of the money system these days, moving money at rapid speeds from one place to another. Mm-hmm. So while we're sleeping, our money's at work on the other side of the world. While they're sleeping, it comes back here. Anything that interrupts that flow will unleash massive inflation.
Huh.
They have to duplicate. Then there's the same money in both places at the same time. That's when inflation kicks in.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we had a discussion, a really interesting discussion with Michael Rosecliffe last week, and he was saying that, you know, part of this agenda of war that we see and, you know, this strife that goes on around the world is using those things, that agenda of war, as a vehicle to increase the velocity of money. Do you agree with that?
Well, not so much the velocity of money as to tone down the inflationary implications of productivity, okay. You know. Right, so if you're creating money at one end of the pipe and it's fueling productivity, then the next thing you know, everyone, you know, the economy's overheating, everyone has money, they're spending it, and prices are rising.
Wow.
But if you could take a portion of that production, you're cranking money into one end of the pipe, at the other end of the pipe, you're taking it away from people in the form of tax and then destroying it with munitions and weapons, then there's no productivity gain. And hence, no inflation.
Ah, so, wow. That's sneaky.
So, yeah, it is way too sneaky. Yeah. I mean, imagine if you did something with it, with created money like a Hoover Dam or like a robot army or, you know, something that's productive, mm-hmm. then pretty soon it starts adding to the standard of living and productivity with raw. So everything they can do to fight inflation and war is definitely won. Most people think it causes inflation. Quite the contrary. Hmm. It fights inflation.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, I want to talk a little bit, too, about future of money. Where do you think we're all going? I mean, with the BRICS development, we've got Bitcoin on the scene now. Like, what do you think is going to happen going forward into the future with our currency and with the currency in the world?
I think the dollar is going to cement its standard as the world currency unit. You know, we're there now. The bulk of the world's trade is conducted in dollars. The bulk of the world's reserves are held in dollars. And now I know China, yeah, going to sell their bonds, right? I know China is going to be a big threat. But it's my contention, and you can kind of scholarly research, that the Chinese were made partners of the very same people that own and control the Federal Reserve as far back as 1973. Huh. And, you know, the idea was, yeah, you got a great system here, but let us show you good modification of our system. You know, strip away the rights that are so pesky and plug in a central bank owned by the government, which is, you know, the absolute ruler of the game.
Right.
You take the profits from the central bank and roll them back into domestic improvements, and within two decades, you can take over the world. I mean, that's essentially where the Chinese are. They own their Federal Reserve. The Central Bank of China is owned by the government, not by the private banks that make up the system.
Okay, okay. Well, then, so you don't see the BRICS thing as being a major development then, or some? I mean, you honestly think that the U.S. dollar is going to retain its standing as the world reserve currency for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, who can make war with this beast? I mean, really? Where? I'd love to see the currency block that can beat the dollar. I'd love to see it. But until it develops, gets some credibility behind it. I mean, China, you know, their currency isn't even convertible. I know they're buying gold, they're trying to make some sort of credibility there. But I do not think that the world is going to suddenly decide to dollar and move into some new currency, whatever it might be.
Huh.
I think the trend is going the other way. I don't know if you saw the Swiss referendum, right?
Uh-huh.
Coming up on the 30th, the Swiss are going to decide whether or not they want to put 20% of their reserves into gold as a national policy,
right,
and that they would repatriate all their gold held around the world, bring it back to Switzerland. That's one. Two, Eiffel is issuing gold coins, silver
yes.
coins,
mm-hmm.
to displace the dollar in its own environment, its own sphere. So in this, I think rather than a replacing currency, I think a reemergence of commodity money, which is what we want, you know, no more fiduciary money, no more money that represents this obligation, but rather money that is in of itself is substance and value. That, I think, is the direction that folks will change. The pendulum is swinging in the other way.
Okay, so you do see then the you know, perhaps the BRICS bank issuing a gold-backed currency, or maybe Russia or China doing something like that as well then?
I would say without that, they have very little chance of success.
Right, and I think that's what we see when you mentioned the fact that China is soaking up gold like a crazy person right now. Russia also, I think they bought 84 tons in the last
yep.
quarter, which was obviously huge. But I want to talk a little bit also about Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is global. It's not tied to a financial center like Wall Street or the Fed. But at the same time, it's freaking fiat. And a lot of people don't seem
right.
to understand that. So I'm curious about what you think about Bitcoin moving forward. Do you think it's valuable? Do you think it's something that we should be looking into? Do you think it's a good model for going forward in general? What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
Well, I don't like money that has no substance. And it is a virtual currency. Every time somebody brings up a Bitcoin, I always joke, you know, well, let me see it.
Right,
upgrade
right.
it. You know, when I can lock it in my vault and know that I control it, then I'll be comfortable with a Bitcoin.
Okay.
And until that happens, I cannot, with good conscience, store my wealth in some electronic representation. That's the bottom line. So I'm opposed to electronic money in every form.
Okay.
Because it relies on someone else's trust and faith. And, in this day and age, commodity money is the way to go. Fiduciary money, whether it's Bitcoin, U.S. dollars, Chinese yuan, you know, where's the substance? That's my question. It's not the quantity of money. And I know quantity theory says because Bitcoins are limited, because there are only, 25 Bitcoins per block.
It says that about silver, too.
Exactly.
I mean, so what are you talking about,
Yeah. What are you talking about? You're talking about a stated limitation of supply growth.
Right.
The Federal Reserve makes the same stated limitation. They say, we're done buying Treasury bonds, right? Quantitative easing is over. But yet you look at the Fed's balance sheet, they bought another $15 billion in bonds this week. So
really? I didn't see that. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, look at H41 release. You
okay.
can get that right from the Fed every Thursday. And look at the Total bonds held outright, you'll see plus 15.175, I think, billion.
Is that a tapering from last month? Is that even at least no?
They stopped. Never mind tapering. They told us they were tapering. That was, you know, May, June, July, they were tapering 10 billion less. They were, Janet Yellen said at the press conference, we are done. It's over. Quarantine is done. Our bond buying program is finished. Fed's balance sheet doesn't reflect that. So, again, any self-imposed limitations, I think of the words of Jefferson, let us not hear of the honor of men. Yeah, I know, there's only going to be 25 minutes. I know there is, yeah. And that's your limitation, self-imposed? Well, if you decide 10 years from now that you want to lift that limitation, there is nothing that can stop you. So in the words of Jefferson, let's not hear about the honor of men. Let's bind them with the chains of the Constitution. A dollar is 1/20th of an ounce of gold, period. Now, you give me a bit standard like that, and I'll listen. But otherwise, I'm not interested in another virtual currency.
I like that. And I think that's important because, you know, you have to also recommend or remember that Bitcoin was developed by a hacker, and there's really nobody on the planet who can actually get to the source code to determine whether or not that limit on the production of Bitcoins is actually valid or not anyway, you know. So there's really no, there's no way that you can know. But at the same time, we were talking about China and Russia soaking up Bitcoin. If you go to, there's a great website called fiatleak.com, fiatleak.com, and you can watch in real time all of the countries around the world buying up Bitcoin. And China, I am telling you, they soak up Bitcoin like you would not believe. The transfer of wealth going into Bitcoin from China right now is staggering. So I don't
know. And for me, you know, the idea of the anonymity is the thing that's attracting people to Bitcoin.
Right.
You know, with cash money, when you get engaged in a transaction, generally I give you the gold coins, you give me the product, no one else is involved, no one else profits from it. There's no banker taking his slice in the middle, and it's completely anonymous. The trade's over, it's done, we're done. Mm-hmm. Once we move to an electronic monetary system with dollars, in the words of Bill Clinton's Secretary of Health and Human Services, she said there's, quote, an off trail of every transaction. Yeah, everything you do is suddenly out there in public view. So if you're a fitness instructor who gets liposuction or, you know, you're doing something that you wouldn't want your followers to know about,
right,
your anonymity is gone with the ability to use electronic money. Bitcoin gave you that back. And I think that, more than anything, is what attracted people to it. But, you know, Bitcoins can be stolen.
Yes.
There's very little, if any, consumer protection. Mm-hmm. And all fees are paid always by the purchaser. So, and you,
I didn't know
you
that.
Buy... Yeah, and if you buy something with Bitcoins and you don't like it, you know, it's not like your credit cards where you get
your Bitcoin.
A lot of times
back.
You don't even know who you bought it from. Chargebacks are impossible.
Oh, wow.
And the idea that people are storing Bitcoin for one reason, not to buy or sell things, but because they're going up, to me, that's like tulip mania. You know, there's no end use for the thing that makes it valuable, and that turns me off. So, unfortunately, right now, Bitcoin is not on my radar as a viable investment vehicle.
Well, that makes sense to me. So what do you think is going to be, if we had to outline a best-case scenario going forward for getting our financial system back on track, what would those moves look like? What do we actually need to do to rescue this system from the clutches of the evil bankers?
Oh, well, you know, two easy things to do. One's called the Chicago Plan by Irving. I mean, he, you know, ran it out, rolled it out in 29, and effectively, but, you know, the stock market crash kind of overshadowed it.
Right.
He suggested a system where you give the power to issue money back to the Treasury and require the banks to have 100% reserves. Now, this would mean this money would be issued by the Treasury and then loaned to the banks. So my suggestion to the Fed is we either switch places with them, or we take them over, one or the other. So, in other words, if you want to continue as a privately held banking concern, then you need 100% reserves. You pay interest to the Fed, to the Treasury, instead of we pay interest to you to run our monetary system. You pay interest to us to use the national franchise, Dollar Inc.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one system. I would go for that. 100% reserves. You could stay privately owned. All money issued by the Treasury. So instead of the Treasury issuing a $100 bill and then selling it to the Fed for the cost of printing, which is 1.5 cents,
right?
And then the Fed giving us back the $100 and saying, Treasury bond that bears interest, they would have to borrow the money from the Treasury and pay interest into the Treasury, so kind of their franchise fee.
Right.
And then the second, I think is an easier solution, is do what we did with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Just take it over, lock, stock, banana stand, we own it, it now belongs to the people. And, you know, it's like when you realize the money machine that the Fed is, I wouldn't be so quick to end it like Ron Paul wanted to do. I would nationalize it, harness its power. If it's going to yield a profit, put that profit in the Treasury, eliminate the income tax. I mean, listen, I would stand a currency that's depreciating 3-5% a year due to inflation, knowing that it's doing that, right? And the government simply issuing the money that it needs to operate. No substance or backing behind it. Nothing would change. The only difference would be we wouldn't be paying $350 billion a year in interest for the privilege of using our own money.
Right.
And we wouldn't have an income tax. You know, get rid of the IRS, get rid of all of it. We don't need a tax. You move the IRS into the Customs Service, replace income tax with a tariff at the border, and take the revenue, the profit from the central bank into the... Now you don't need an income tax. Sales taxes run the states. And we're off to the races. We'll be back on track in 10 years.
Wow. Well, I like it. Is there anybody out there actively working to make that happen? Or what are the things that would have to happen? You know, the dominoes are...
Oh, hell no.
No.
You know what? The moment I attack that free trade canard, I'm done. I'm toast. You know, they move their factories to places where they don't need environmental regulations, where they don't need worker safety regulations, where they can exploit anyone who comes in their path.
Right.
Can't do that in the United States. You know, free people don't stand for that sort of thing. And so the regulations that we put in place to hamper industry here are bypassed by free trade. So no tariffs, no sir. You can make the moment you say it sounds like you want tariffs, your agenda is dead. And that's my agenda involves tariffs, I'm done for. And then taking over the Fed, forget it. You know, the number one contributor to both sides of the party right now, right? Democrats, Republicans, I don't care who you are, even independents, all of your money comes from the owners of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
All of it.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, they're lawyers and lobbyists. So we have no chance as a citizenry of getting either of these initiatives anywhere near. Now, if you want to talk about ending the Fed, abolishing the Fed, oh boy, you can get all the funding you want for that because any economist will tell you you're toast. You have no chance of ever getting that done.
Wow. What an amazing conversation today, Andrew. Thank you so much for joining us on Red Pill Reports today. We are just about out of time. I would love to have you back on to talk a little bit more about where we think all of this is heading sometime in the future.
Well, you got the hotline.
I do.
Call me whenever you want. And I'll tell you what, I have 3 audio CDs for your listeners if they're interested in learning more.
Yeah.
The Federal Reserve is number one. It's a half-hour CD.
Okay. It
tells you about the Fed. Number two is the definition of money. What the heck is a dollar? That's the second CD. Protecting your wealth, that was commercial. It tells you how to buy gold, how to buy it without getting your pants pressed, how to take possession and so forth.
Right.
You can call 800-468-2646. Mention Red Pill, you'll get it free. 800-468-2646.
Awesome, Andrew. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. Join us Monday. We will have Jamie Henshaw on. We'll be talking about the Monarch programming and mind control. It's going to be a fantastic week. I hope all of you enjoyed the conversation today, and I hope all of you have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. We will see you again on Monday. Take care, everybody.
We think first of vague words that are synonyms for progress and pair them with footage of a high-speed train. Science is doing lots of stuff that may or may not have anything to do with us. See how this guy in a lab coat holds up a beaker? That means we do research. But we also do business in the USA, or want you to think we do. Check out this wind energy thing in Indiana, and this blue-collar guy with dirt on his face. Lest you think we're a faceless entity, look at all these attractive people. using a specific ratio of Asian people to black people to women to white men, we want to make sure we represent your needs and interests, or at least a version of your skin color in our ads. Did we put a baby in here? Yep.